It's Wednesday, January 20th, 2021, and this is yet another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly conversation on media behaviors comes to you from across the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Amy Simons, and I'm in our studios on the lower level of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Joining me from their corners of our school, my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. Hi, Kathy, how are you doing today?
Hello down there.
Hello, and hi to Ernest.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, doing well. On today's program, the swearing-in of our 46th President of the United States of America. We'll also talk about some of the pardons former President Trump announced before leaving office, and when what a reporter sees, hears, and shares with their audience, with us, and it can all get to be too much. What happens in that moment? There's a lot more that we will talk about as well before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with that history that was made at 11 o'clock our time today as Joe Biden took the oath of office, becoming the 46th president of the United States of America. Right beside him, Kamala Harris, the nation's new vice president. Your reaction to what we saw this morning? I know you were spending a lot of time in the classroom and with our students this morning, too.
I was, but it was a good experience, I think, to show them and to share with them and to talk about. It's a very unusual inauguration in many respects. First of all, most importantly, for the first time in the history of the United States of America, there is somebody in national office who is not a white male. I have been a reporter for a pretty long time, and I was wondering if I was ever going to see this day. So that's really remarkable, I think, and it is indeed historic. It's been a long time coming. Nothing against our white male friends, but it's nice to try something different sometimes. And then, of course, the inauguration itself was very unusual. Normally, Washington is absolutely packed. We didn't see that. And, you know, with all due respect to our new president, I will disagree with one thing he said. He talked about a peaceful transfer of power. I don't think we really can say we had that 100%. Part of the reason Washington was as vacant as it was is COVID, but part of that was security. And the pictures that I saw of the military strength on the streets of the Capitol were really unnerving. And I think it should give all of us as Americans pause to think about what that means, that that's what it really takes for us to move from one party to another. I think we have some soul searching to do as a country.
You bring up that idea of the security, and I know it really hit home for me over the weekend when a student who was in one of my non-journalism classes had indicated to me that he is, or classes for non-journalism majors, that he's a member of the Missouri Army National Guard and that he had been called up and was going to be completing this mission and looking for accommodations. And in that moment, it struck me just how unusual this really was. Ernest, I want to ask you too about what this meant in watching it for you as well. Chris Wallace described Biden's inauguration speech as one of the best he had ever seen, heard, or read. In that moment, what kind of reactions were you having?
Well, I mean, I really did like his speech. I think that he was very forceful in trying to drive home unity. I think Kathy does make a very good point about the fact that it's difficult to think about the country being unified in light of what happened on January 6th, and the aftermath of that. I mean, we continue to get these reports coming out about the level at which there may have been planning involved in the insurrection and that sort of thing. I'm also struck by, you know, the usually in those inaugural speeches, when he gets to a certain point, you hear the roar of the crowd and that sort of thing, and it just wasn't there. I mean, it was really evident, the tone of it. He was trying his best in his speech, and I think he did about as well as can be expected in his speech in trying to show an uplift, a moving forward, a let's work together to try to make things better. Not just in the near future, but further into the future. But man, the lack of a crowd really showed in the way in which he in his speech and in other instances of the inauguration proceedings.
Kathy, one of the things that you and I were talking about during different points of the day is that this inauguration day is going to look very different. We're recording this program as we usually do, and right now it's about 1:30 in the afternoon, so there are still a lot of things that are going on, right? President Biden has already signed a couple of his first executive orders, but normally we'd be looking at having a big parade right now. There would be luncheons with lawmakers, members of Congress. A lot of those things are looking different, and that's going to also create a very different experience in terms of what's going on in the physical transition of the White House right now, something that you have actually seen firsthand.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating couple of hours to be at the White House, and I've done this on inauguration days after I got sick of being outside in the cold. But it actually is a fun thing to do. And I was laughing when you were talking, because when you said there are things going on, I was just watching some of that on C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking there's a lot of vamping going on, because as you correctly said, there's usually a lot of ceremony involved that takes several hours. And so the president doesn't get back to the White House for a number of hours. And what Joe Biden and his team are doing is they're building in a lot of these little ceremonies instead of having a lunch with people, which they can't do because of COVID. They're building these little ceremonies in. He's going to Arlington with the former presidents. And the reason for that is that in the period of time between when the former president leaves the White House and the new one arrives, the entire White House is remodeled, and according to the wishes of the incoming president. And there are literally school buses filled with workmen and workwomen already wearing their knee pads, and they've got all their buckets and their paint ready. And they're waiting just outside the line of sight in the big oval and the ellipse behind the White House. And as soon as the former president leaves, boom, they are in the door and they are hammering, sawing, and the whole building is filled with paint smells. And so by the time the new first family comes back, it is a very different looking place. The Oval Office looks completely different. I saw it transform between Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. And it was just a remarkable thing, and how quickly that's done. And of course, this time it's complicated because, as you pointed out, there's less ceremony to fill that time to give the work people more room to work. And then COVID, you know, I would think it would be complicating some of the move-in of the White House.
One of the things this morning that struck me as this was happening was I was in one of the conference rooms here in the School of Journalism watching it on one of the cable news networks, and a colleague came in and said, "Hey, can I come watch with you?" And I said, "Sure, why not? It's a big enough room, we can distance." And she said, "I was just watching it on NBC, and I was really kind of disappointed that they weren't focusing on the inauguration itself. I didn't need to see Trump landing in a helicopter in Florida. I wanted to focus just on the events that were going on and the new president." Ernest, you're nodding your head. We are going to have some things about Trump and what has gone on in the last 24 hours and what he has done. But talk for a minute about why you're nodding your head, why you're reacting as I'm looking at you and having.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised by the fact that the media was focused in on that. I mean, and I sort of went back in my head at previous inaugurations, and usually they would show, because the president would be there at the inauguration, would leave right after the inauguration, and they would, the media would show that. They'd show him getting on Marine One, going to Andrews, hopping on the plane and leaving. And at that point, that would be the end of it. But I think because Trump wasn't going to be at the inauguration, They determined that we're going to show him leaving the White House, we're going to show him getting on the plane, we're going to show him landing in Florida, because he's not at the inauguration. And I think that they may have taken his news judgment just to show, look, you know, when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are being sworn in, you're in Florida. I mean, I think they were sending I wonder if they were sending a message about how different this inauguration is compared to others. And I guess just the sort of stark disrespect that shows to the incoming president. And they wanted to highlight that, maybe for history. But I think that may have been their reasoning for doing it. I mean, that's, you know, my interpretation.
I agree with Ernest. I think it's very different. You know, I think for viewers who aren't inauguration geeks like I've been, normally the president, the incoming and the outgoing president have coffee together at the White House. And normally it's the outgoing president doesn't leave until after the inauguration, when he is escorted down the east front steps of the Capitol by the incoming president. And that ceremony that Ernest just described happened. The closest thing we came to that today was when Kamala Harris walked Mike Pence down the east front steps of the Capitol and bid him adieu. But there is, you know, I think that kind of symbolism, it's not being there. It's symbolic, but I think the lack of those visuals speaks volumes about how much work Joe Biden has to do. And he's in many ways, he's well qualified to do this, mm-hmm. but it's an awful big ask.
So Trump's exit this morning, I don't know about either one of you. I set an alarm for 6 o'clock this morning to see what was going to happen.
Happened at 12:30 last night.
Interesting. Go ahead. Tell me why you're saying that.
Well, because I woke up this morning and there were a whole series of tweets at 12:30 our time, which meant it was happening at 1:30 on the East Coast about the pardon.
Okay.
You talk about 11th hour, and some of these pardons, I got to say, were really worthy of the dark of night. were a white collar criminal or some big celebrity, you got a pardon.
Or the brother of a professional football player.
Or the former mayor of Detroit.
Or Steve Bannon, a presidential advisor and at one time leader of Breitbart News. Talk about the decision to pardon him on that one, Kathy.
Well, I mean, this is somebody who ultimately could testify against the president. There's a lot of speculation, or the former president, there's a lot of speculation that now he is the former president. He's in a lot of legal jeopardy, not just on a federal level, but I would think more so from the state of New York. Mm-hmm. Where there seems to be a really aggressive prosecution going on. And the Bannon-Trump relationship has been very much up and down. Bannon's somebody whom prosecutors might have squeezed, but now seems to be off the hook.
Ernest, one of the names that had been bandied around that people had been looking to see if a pardon would be given to was Julian Assange. That did not happen.
No, it didn't happen. I mean, and I'm pretty sure that there's some people surprised that it didn't happen. But, you know, I think it may have been one of those situations where someone on his national security team may have gotten to him and said, look, you know, we know you're going to give these pardons, but this is one you really don't want to do, because, I mean, you have enough issues going on with the insurrection and everything else. You don't need to have one more thing. And a pardon to Julian Assange would send a very, very bad message, not only domestically, but also internationally. And I think he may have made a decision, or someone may have helped him to make a decision, that this is one person you don't want to pardon.
Well, and the other decision like that was Sheldon Silver, the former New York State legislative leader. And that was clearly a strategic leak by somebody in the White House, put the word out that this was going to happen. And when that report hit, the level of outrage was so intense. I mean, even the New York Post, which is normally a very loyal, has been a very loyal editorial page to Donald Trump, said, don't do this. And he didn't. So I think this is, of course, what strategic leaks are all about. Someone on the inside is afraid something really bad is going to happen, tells the press, it becomes public, and the reaction is enough to convince the boss to back off.
So one of the constitutional crises that journalists had been waiting to potentially jump to cover would be that self-pardon or the pardon of any of the Trump children, also not included there. But what we are going to be looking at is that Nancy Pelosi and the House are still holding articles of impeachment that once delivered to the Senate, there is 24 hours to begin that trial. So former President Trump is still going to likely be in the news for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. The comments that were made by now, I guess, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on yesterday about how, you know, the president, the former president, his role and responsibility in what happened on January 6th was quite striking. And you have a lot of pundits out there who are saying this may be Mitch McConnell and some of the establishment Republicans' opportunity to basically take the Republican Party back, as some of the pundits are saying, because right now there's a definite split in the party, and it is either you're going to be on the side of Mitch McConnell and the establishment Republicans, or you're going to be on the side of Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and the what some are calling the insurrectionist part of the Republican Party. And Mitch McConnell may be playing this as, you know what, we're going to leave the threat of the establishment voting with the Democrats to impeach Trump if you guys don't start playing the ball the way we want the ball to be played within the party.
Yeah, just to add to that, yeah. I think that to underline what Ernest said, there was another strategic leak last week to both, I think, the New York Times and then the Washington Post, or maybe I have that reversed, but at any rate, both of those newspapers very quickly had the same story in the Associated Press, which was that Mitch McConnell welcomes the Democratic efforts. And I think that was very significant. You would not print that unless you had it either from Mitch McConnell himself or somebody very, very close to him. And that tells me that McConnell is thinking exactly the way Ernest described.
Okay. It has been a very big news day. There is still going to be a lot to develop between the time we finish recording today's show and our radio listeners have the opportunity to listen to it. There are still a few other things that I want to be able to touch on today. Students are back in public schools here in Columbia. Yesterday, classes started again on the Mizzou campus, and we are still waiting here in Boone County and mid-Missouri and the state as a whole for more detail on the rollout of COVID vaccinations. Ernest, the governor did lay out a plan on Thursday, something we didn't have when we were talking about this last week. But as we were looking at some of the local coverage during the course of this time, there's still a lot of ambiguity in that plan, most notably the where, the when, and the how that those vaccines are going to come available to us.
I mean, yes, I mean, the governor laid out a plan, but that plan, I think, caused more anxiety and than anything else, because people are saying, okay, am I in 1A? Am I in 1B1? Am I in 1B2? Am I in phase this? Am I in phase that?
The confusion that comes in the terms phase and tier and how, right, those are being used interchangeably, absolutely, making it even more confusing.
Yes. And above all, where's the vaccine? You know, people basically saying, where is it? Because the hospitals who initially had vaccine are basically saying, look, either we have used all the vaccine that we have, or we are still in phase one and we don't have enough vaccine at the current time to go past phase 1A. So that's where we are right now in Boone County and in much of mid-Missouri. We have no idea about the capacity of the healthcare system to actually do this. And there's also confusion about where are you going to get your vaccine. Are you going to, because everybody's getting different information. If you're connected in some way to MU Healthcare, you're getting an email. If you are connected in some way to Boone Hospital, you get another email. And then you get conflicting information coming in from Boone County Health. So, you know, and then you have people saying, well, do you get it at Walgreens? Do you get it at CVS? That's a part of the what's going on right here, is that you have the state and the governor with a so-called plan, but it is so vague and creates so much anxiety that people are angry at this point, that they were told one thing and now there's just total confusion.
It's always good to have a plan. It's another thing to be able to implement it. Kathy, right. Talk for a second about how journalists can apply, and if they even really can effectively apply pressure to begin to move this along in any way, if vaccine is somewhere, to bring it to Missouri and make it available.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because yesterday, yeah, some of our sophomore journalists, we put them to work on exactly this question, asking a lot of the questions Ernest did. And we had students call 27 or 28 supposed alleged vaccination outlets in mid-Missouri, and not a single one of them was inoculating anybody below 1A. And most of them had not gotten vaccines yet. And many of them, one pharmacist told one of our student reporters, I just got off the phone with the lieutenant governor's office. I have no idea when we're getting this vaccine. I don't know what's going on. So there seems to be a lot of confusion.
And this was in multiple counties?
And we just checked Boone.
Okay.
But yes, I would think that Boone County, because it's a little more urban, is probably better off than most, and that's not good. We do know there are some counties in our area that don't have any vaccine at all. So I think this is, as I like to put it, it's a plan that's more hat than cattle at this point. And I think the best thing journalists can do is keep making the calls, and we will keep doing it here at the Missouri School of Journalism, to try to highlight this situation. And one would think it's certainly one of the top priorities of Joe Biden's administration is to get a more organized, orchestrated plan for distribution. But I think, Ernest really nailed it. It was just kind of all of a sudden the government said last week, the feds, oh, well, now we're into the next tier. And whoops, it seemed to be a complete surprise, at least to the people we talked to in this area, to the providers. And nobody was prepared for it. And nobody has what they need to start inoculating, because this next tier is really more like the general public. It's people of a certain age who have certain medical conditions, and they just don't seem ready for it at all.
The other thing to me about this is that, you know, you see other governors from around the country that are really pushing the federal government about what they claim they were capable of doing and able to do and have not done. Our governor, you haven't seen that. And what's going to be striking to me is whether or not you're going to see some of these governors who were supporters of Trump, are they going to begin to push against the Biden administration in the way in which they did not push against the Trump administration?
Okay. These stories of COVID, of insurrections, they're all real life. And sometimes it can be easy to forget that the journalists reporting them experience a certain level of secondary trauma, witnessing what they're witnessing, telling the emotional stories that they're telling. Never was that more clear than when Sarah Seidner reacted to seeing her own video report play during a CNN live shot.
I apologize. I'm going to try to get through this. This is the 10th hospital that I have been in. And to see the way that these families have to live after this and the heartache that goes so far and so wide. It's really hard to take. It's just not okay. It's not okay what we're doing to each other. These families should not be going through this. No family should be going through this. So please listen to what this family is saying. Don't let this be you. Do whatever you can to keep this from killing your family members and your neighbors and your friends and your teachers and doctors and firefighters. All of these people are here to help you, but you have to do your part.
So journalists have been sharing a meme on social media this week about the ways that our friends and family can take special care of us to catch us as we fall, because the exhaustion is setting in. Ernest, Seidner was really disappointed in herself for breaking down like that. But journalists across the country have been praising her for her realness and her humanity and allowing herself to feel in that moment.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things that you don't see quite often from reporters. And we've all witnessed a lot of it. So I think it's something that they're going to have to really pay more attention to and let them have their humanity and have their moment.
Kathy, another thing about this that is really kind of interesting to me, we've had 4 years, five if you count the campaign of covering Donald Trump, which has been running on a hamster wheel. It's been never ending. Add to that what we've experienced and covered in 2020, where you bring COVID into that, where you bring the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests, then you bring in the election and the campaign, and then January 6th and the insurrection. We have been going full stop. And you have to almost wonder, where and when do journalists get a break? And how much of the contraction of our industry has led to this physical exhaustion that we're seeing in so many of our colleagues?
Yeah, well, I'll say two things. One, I think that reporter's reaction was absolutely okay. I mean, I know especially women feel badly about showing emotions, but we did, I think, a couple of weeks ago show a young man working for MSNBC kind of catching himself with emotion, talking about people lined up for food. And I think that kind of emotion is, it's genuine. We need to be transparent about what we're seeing. But I would also say that yes, I think the insecurity that journalists are facing, the financial insecurity, we are all trying to do more with less. And I want to say that what we saw on January 6th at the Capitol, I think should be a wake-up call to every American. You know, journalists have been putting themselves out there, and I know it's popular to kick us around, but if you didn't have the information that journalists gave you, we would all be a lot worse off. We couldn't function. And to have journalists physically threatened because of what they do for a living, you know, journalists have been there and stood up for people who lost their homes, who have been in a disaster, who have lost everything in a flood. And by bringing that news to people, they've enabled people to help. It's time for other people to help journalists right now. It's really important for our leaders and our readers and our viewers and our listeners to stand up for us, because we won't be there. I mean, this is a very frightening thing to have to go talk to students about why they should still be journalists when this kind of stuff is happening. Think about it, people.
Okay, and on that note, a perfect way to end today's show. That music means we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for our original theme music.